hearing is officially called to order at 1:05 on Wednesday, March. This is wrong. It's April 1st. But that's pretty darn close to the right date. Present are Representative Lynn and Keller, and Pruitt, and Holmes, and Gruenberg, and Thompson, and myself, Chair Gatta, which looks like we have a full house. Reminder, we have some issues with cell phones, so turn them off. Today's agenda, three things. First, I'm going to deal with HB 179, animal cruelty. After we dispose of that one, I'm going to move right into the one we had been discussing for at least one day, maybe longer, HB 88, use of foreign law. And God bless, if we ever get past that, we'll go right to HB 1. Number one, policy for securing health care services. So let me begin with House Bill 179, animal cruelty. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill today. You've probably heard that authorities had seized some 150 dogs that were allegedly neglected or dead from a place up in Willow. Unfortunately, this is not an isolated incident. Since 2008, animal control officers have had to rescue multiple neglected animals all at the same time in other parts of Alaska Valley, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Dillingham, and who knows where else. And again, these are the only new the cases that we know about, and there could well be more. Cases of mass animal cruelty are shocking and also overwhelm state services. Clinics that might have to handle the arrival of dozens of unhealthy animals all at once aren't equally suited to care for dozens of those who get intake of dozens of healthy animals are not equally suited to large intakes of unhealthy, emaciated, or mistreated animals. In response to this problem, I've offered HB 179 as before today that would make five or more cases of criminal neglect the one continuous episode a Class C felony. Prosecutors have had to charge each of these crimes as individual misdemeanors, and this bill would fix that. The gravity of the charge should reflect the gravity of the crime. Let me be clear, this bill is not about the number of animals any individuals can possess. People can have as many animals as they like, so long as they care for them properly. A stiff penalty will discourage people from taking on multiple animals without the ability or intention to care for each and every one of them. I hope you'll join me in taking a strong stand against serial animal cruelty. And I respectfully request your support of HB 179. I have my able staffer here, Thomas Reicher, who can speak to the bill also and go through some of the details if the committee would like.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question going back to page 2, line 11, 12, 13.
Wait a minute, I got to get to it.
Which is the...
That would be the bill.
The language.
The bill, right?
That would be the relevant language, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let me... There we go. Too many papers.
Sorry.
Give me the location again.
Page 2, the new print, section 8.
Okay.
And what I'm looking at... contemporaneously fails to care for five or more animals and as a result causes the death of five or more animals or causes severe physical pain or prolonged suffering to five or more animals.
Okay.
So if they do it to four animals but not five?
It'd be misdemeanors.
Okay. That's, I guess, what I'm asking. If they... Is there anything in the bill that tends to narrow it down that says if you do four animals in January and another one in March... you've now crossed into the bill.
I believe this is all in one circumstance. It is not cumulative. You know, one animal this year, another animal next year, another animal the year after that. That would be absurd.
Okay.
And, you know, the number could have been four, it could have been five, it could have been six, or any number you wanted to choose, but five appeared to be the most appropriate number, the most practical number.
And since I come from the Mad Valley, let me tell you, we just built a huge new animal shelter because of the number of cases that keep showing up at the shelter. And I think we did a pretty good job, but this is, and no matter what, 100 and something dogs overwhelms any facility.
That's correct.
And we're trying to avoid people who cause that much harm to the community, as well as the dogs are captive, probably not able to escape, and if they did, things might even be worse because they're domesticated. So,
yes.
Within the committee, do we have any questions?
Mr.
Representative Holmes?
Just a bit of a clarification on your question and the answer. I think if you look at back on page 1, section 8.2, starting on line 8, page 1, says with criminal negligence fails to care for an animal and as a result causes the death of the animal or severe physical pain or prolonged suffering, and that would be the one animal, and that would be a misdemeanor. However, if you look on section 2, on page 2, subsection H, starting on line 15, it lays out the penalties, and it clarifies that it's a misdemeanor for the first, but if you have been have a prior conviction for that within 10 years, your second offense would be bumped up to a felony anyway. So under existing law, if it was one animal 1 year, one animal the next year, one animal the next year, it already would. The second offense would be a felony already under our current law as it is. This second offense within 10 years would already be a felony. This would just deal with the fact that if there were multiples all at one time. So I think, Mr. Chairman, your question about what if they're separated in time, that's, I believe, already the law.
Addressed here. Representative Thompson?
That concerns me a bit. So the man comes home and he kills his dog cruelly. And now a couple months later he comes home and he's mad. And instead of taking out the dog, because that would be a felony now, he goes ahead and beats up his wife, which is a misdemeanor. I don't feel comfortable with that scenario at all. I mean, why hurt the dog? Because it'll be a felony. I'll beat my wife up. It's a misdemeanor.
That's like a country western song.
Yeah, I think there might be one like that.
Well,
it doesn't banish the
Representative Lynn?
Well, through the chair, you know, obviously, it depends on the assault. It could be a misdemeanor assault. It could be a felony assault. You know, who knows? Domestic violence is a tremendous challenge in the state, and I don't think there's a nexus between this and that, really.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, I'm very, obviously, very sympathetic to that point of view. We certainly don't want to be creating higher penalties for animals than humans. That would be creating weird dynamics. However, the standard, I think, under the subsection 2, for severe physical pain or prolonged suffering, if you were to inflict that similar type of behavior, that's a pretty high standard. I don't think it's just kicking your dog. You'd have to be basically, it's a lot higher than that. And I think if you were to do the similar level of damage to a human, it would be a felony as well.
Representative Holmes, question for you. It's not uncommon in Alaska to find out your dog is pregnant. And you find out when they're pretty close to delivering, they start developing structures, and they deliver 7 puppies. You don't want any of them. And you decide to dispose of them yourself with a 22 shot. Are you now a felon?
Under the language of the bill?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you've caused the death.
That's a good question. Might be a good question for
Thomas.
Our legislative legal.
For the record, my name is Thomas Riker, and I'm staff to Representative Bob Lynn. In dealing with the animal cruelty changes that came through last year, that was something that was brought up. And if you look at subsection 2, page 1, line 8, it says with criminal negligence fails to care for an animal and as a result causes the death. So, I don't want to get into the legal hypothetical of what, animal control officers, Department of Law would decide to do if you did shoot 6 puppies, but you have not caused their death through criminal negligence. You've taken out a gun and shot them, so.
To the attorneys on the panel, does that make sense? Representative Grunberg?
Are we going to hear from Ms. Carpinetti or somebody from law?
She just gave me that up and down sign. So
I think a lot of these questions are for her.
Please step forward. Ms. Carpinetti.
Good
We also have Doug Gardner online from Ledge Legal. So, Doug, are you listening to this?
I am, Chairman Dotto.
Appreciate it. Thank you. We have Annie Carpinetti on the microphone now. She's just about to put herself on the record.
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I'm here to answer questions. And the question I heard was whether if you shot an
seven,
animal.
Six puppies.
If you look at 1161-140A, animals in our state are considered property, and you can cause their death, but you can't do so by knowingly inflicting severe and prolonged physical pain or suffering. So shooting an animal probably would be fine. It would be fine, but the law prohibits a person from killing an animal using a decompression chamber or using poison, those means, but by just taking the life of an animal, if you do so in a humane manner, it would not be considered a crime in our state.
Yeah, bullets are instantaneous. How about drowning? Does this cross the line?
Through the chair, I guess it would depend on the circumstances. I would imagine that drowning would probably not be considered prolonged physical pain or suffering. That's my guess.
Okay, don't leave.
Don't leave us. Please don't leave us.
Any more questions from the committee? I'm going to go to public testimony. Kayla, you're sitting right there in the audience. The Anchorage Animal Control Advisory Board. Perfect person. Would you step forward, please? Annie, you stay there. Let her take Thomas's seat.
Mr. Chair.
Make yourself comfortable.
Conflict of interest?
I think I need to disclose that I know this woman.
In the biblical sense.
How long have you been married?
A day or more.
Mr. Chair, I was actually... next week, Kayla's going to deliver the invocation. And it was 20 years ago, almost to the day, that she delivered the invocation on the floor, and that's when I met her.
Wow. It's party time.
Prayers were answered.
I'm sure we can get some testimony out of you. Once again, put yourself on the record, Anchorage Animal Care and Control Advisory Board. Is that correct?
That is correct. Animal Care and Control Advisory Board.
Okay, Kayla, go ahead. Tell us what you think we need to know.
Well, first I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak on behalf of Bill 179. I've been watching the work that you've all been doing, and we would like to commend you. We started out with no law, then we came up with a toothless law, then we came up with a law with some substance. It's not perfect, but we're very happy with it. And we would like to continue working towards that end. First, each step toward preventing animal cruelty is, for us, a step in the right direction. Second, multiple criminal neglect cases bring a large burden to the municipality of origin. We recently had a case that involved 8 dogs, 23 cats, and 1 bird, which took over a year to resolve. And during that time, the law did not allow us to find new owners for those pets because the accused was not yet convicted and she wanted her animals back. The court determined that the animals cost the municipality over $77,000. And that is a low ball figure because food companies came forward, people came and took care of those dogs in their own homes, and veterinarians provided care and medicines at no cost. So this is a very low ball figure. And this does not include anything having to do with the investigation, just the food and medical care. Once the owner was convicted of animal cruelty, the judge allowed us to remove an approximate 50 additional animals from a second facility. It was a nightmare in logistics, in expenses, and emotional pain to both the staff and volunteers who had to care for these sick and dying animals. We urge the passage of this bill. However, we also regret the arbitrary number of 5 must be used to determine if the situation arises to the level of a felony. each animal suffering from criminal neglect, not simply stupid neglect or ignorant neglect, should be a felony in our eyes. It's just simply criminal behavior. And as we understand it, there is not the will to pass such legislation at this time, but we would like you to consider changing the number of animals from 5 to 3. We see this bill as a step in the right direction. It will save animals from needless suffering and cities from suffering losses in important resources. We approve this bill for taking a logical step to fix a true problem.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. We have two more people. Deborah Gardner, Fairbanks, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead and sign in and give us any affiliation you have, as well as your last name.
My name is Deborah Gail Gardner. I am a volunteer with the Brooklyn Pet Rescue.
Okay, give us your testimony.
I am here to support the bill. I agree with the Anchorage Animal and Care testimony that it's a good start. It would be nice to see any kind of criminal negligence be felony. As a volunteer rescue, I end up caring for animals that find themselves in these situations. It is very overwhelming of our resources. It is heartbreaking work to care for animals who are very sick and unsocialized, as they usually are. And for cats especially, this is a death sentence.
Okay.
So I'm testifying in support of it.
Okay, we've got you down as supportive. I'll go next to another Fairbanks person, Ronnie Rosenberg. Ronnie, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. My name is Ronnie Rosenberg, and I am the president of the Fairbanks Animal Shelter Fund, which is the support group for the Fairbanks North Shore Borough Animal Shelter. And in addition, I am the chairperson of the Fairbanks North Shore Borough Animal Control Commission. I've been active in animal control issues for over 15 years in the state of Alaska. Over the years, we have seen several of these cases involving breeders, hoarders, and other individuals where they have large numbers of animals and they neglect or abuse a whole large group. So, and I feel that it is really important that this pass. April, as you probably know, is Prevention of Animal Cruelty Month throughout the United States. These problems, when they arise, these congregate problems are a tremendous burden. They are very, very expensive, and they cause great disruption in the community. I feel that an enhanced sentence for a felony makes sense. And I would concur with Ms. Parfinetti that shooting your animal in Alaska is not a problem. Certainly out in the rural areas, but sometimes it's the only way to manage a situation. We're not talking about someone who shoots an animal. We're talking about someone who tortures or for days on end for no apparent reason does not feed their animals or care for them in any kind of reasonable situation. So for all of those reasons, I feel that this bill should pass, and I urge that you vote it out of committee.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. For the sake of the committee here, we also have a letter from Sally Clampett, addressed to Lynn Gatto, Chenault, Guttenberg, Gardner, and it says, Dear Representative Lynn Gatto, Chenault, Guttenberg, Gardner, I won't read the whole letter to you, but I'll give you the last paragraph. We're very grateful to all of you for your interest and hard work on behalf of animals and hope you will take HB 79 just one more notch to make it truly effective and meaningful for those creatures who depend entirely upon your decisions for their very lives. So I'll tell Sally Clampett, thank you, Executive Director of Alaska SPCA, right there in Anchorage. Okay. Any more people want to testify?
I have a question.
Close public testimony. Bring it back to the committee. Representative Grunberg.
These are questions for Ms. Carpenter.
She had to leave. She went to finance. So.
Well, maybe for Mr. Gardner then.
He's online.
Mr. Gardner, can you hear me?
I sure can.
Okay. This is, and I'm having the whole statute drafted. Subsection B of this statute, which doesn't appear in the bill, says that each animal is a separate offense. And so presumably, if I may ask a series of questions, Mr. Chair, presumably, if let us say you have a kennel and you fail to put out enough food for 10 animals, even though it's one act, and 10 animals suffer or die, you could be charged with 10 separate offenses, right?
I agree with that.
Could you be sentenced consecutively? So in other words, it could be 10 separate consecutive sentences, not concurrent. Now, this is a thing of mathematics. If it's a Class B, a Class C felony, what is the incarceration?
Through the Chair, Chairman Gatto, Doug Gardner, representing Legislative Legal. Representative Grunberg, you're asking what the penalty would be for a felony, a first outing for a person committing a felony, is that right?
Class C.
Class C would be 0 to 2 years. Absent the presence of an aggravating factor, right now I can't think of an aggravating factor that would obviously apply to an animal cruelty case. I haven't reviewed that, but absent an aggravator would be 0 to 2 years.
Okay, so consecutive sentences, four animals die, five animals die. Ironically, if you're convicted under this, you'd only get 2 years. But if you were convicted of five separate Class A misdemeanors, each carrying a maximum of 1 year, you could get up to 5 years currently.
This one is 0 to 2 years.
Right, but the maximum's two.
Maximum's two. Yep.
And under a misdemeanor, Class A is 1 year.
Is it 0 to 1 or 1?
0 to 1, yeah. Yeah. I'm talking about maximum here. So, under the current law, without this bill, five animals die, you could get up to 5 years, right, Mr. Gardner, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think that anomalous result is possible. I think it's probably less likely in practical reality, but you are exactly right. It is conceivable that could happen.
So, under the bill, and this is the fact that you and I know, and I don't know the rest of the committee understands, is that if we pass this bill, the court really could not impose five separate misdemeanors. They'd apply what's called the rule of lenity, and they'd have to sentence them basically under a felony, and the maximum would go down from 5 years to 2 years, right?
I think the prosecution, through the chair, would always have the discretion to charge misdemeanors, or if there were five animals under this proposed provision, the prosecution could charge a felony. I think that the decision the prosecution made in terms of the theory of the case would drive the way that the court sentenced, and if the prosecution picks misdemeanors, then it's misdemeanors. If the prosecution picks a felony, then you're right. That would be the way the court would go.
Suppose, if I may, suppose the prosecution pick misdemeanors. Could not the defense attorney then say, court, you should only sentence me to 2 years because that's really, under the rule of lenity, the maximum that you should impose? What do you think a trial court, or particularly an appellate court, would say? Would they apply the rule of lenity and take judicial notice of this statute?
Yeah. Can you tell the committee what lenity means?
Leniency.
Leniency. Got it.
It's called L-E-N-I-T-Y, but in this case it means leniency. If there are two separate interpretations of a criminal statute, they will adopt the one that is the most lenient, favors the defendant. That's a general rule of criminal law. Isn't that true, Mr. Gardner?
I think that that's fair, and I think that it is likely that, through the chair, I think it is likely that a sentencing judge in a misdemeanor case might hear a comment that, well, judge, you shouldn't give the defendant more time than you would have gotten for a felony. And I think that that argument might have some traction with a trial court judge. So I agree that that argument would have some receptiveness with a trial court judge. I don't know what the Court of Appeals would do, I think that you've got a valid point.
May I continue, Mr. Chairman?
Please do.
And I like the bill, but I just think it's important on this committee that we understand all the legal implications of what we do, and that's why I'm bringing this up.
Through the chair, Representative Bloomberg, could I just add one more comment to my prior comment?
Sure.
You know, I think that generally speaking, the effect of a felony, it may be sometimes that a person would get sentenced to a little less time on a felony, but with a felony come a lot of other factors, and you know that in terms of possibly longer length of probation, supervised probation, and the other long-ranging effects of felonies. I think sometimes judges take that into account in a felony sentencing and don't so much perhaps in a misdemeanor. So while there could be an anomalous result where a person could get 4 years consecutively on four misdemeanors and maybe 2 years on a first C felony, those things, that's less likely to happen, but I think sometimes judges take into account the impact of a felony and weigh that against misdemeanor sentencing time as well.
Yes, of course. Okay. Now, this is another question, and if the members would look, page 1, line 8, it says criminal negligence, and page 2, line 11, criminal negligence. The reason I'm using this is because sub 2 and sub 8 in the law, assuming this passes, are very similar. The only difference is the number of animals in one would be a felony and the other is a Class A misdemeanor. If you, does the fact that, this may be overly technical, if somebody acted recklessly, would that qualify, that more than meets the requirements of criminal negligence, and you could be convicted if the proof indisputably showed that you acted recklessly, you'd still meet the requirement to be prosecuted under either A2 or A8, correct?
Through the chair, I think that's right. If a person acted intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, which are higher mental states, I think they would necessarily be committing or acting with the criminal negligence mental state, which is, of course, the lowest in the criminal statute.
And finally, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Let's assume that a person owns and runs a notorious puppy mill, and they are not they're breeding, they're inbreeding animals deliberately and stuff like that, and they could say, well, I guess that would be a failure to care if they're inbreeding and causing all kinds of problems that lead, because Kayla and I wound up with a dog from a puppy mill with just quite a terrible life, despite living with us, probably because of it. But, you know, what
I'm speaking for yourself.
Oh, no, Kayla was, I don't know if she's still here.
She's still here. Yeah. She's listening to you.
I used to campaign, and I'd say we have this dog, Lightning, but we call him Worthless. Anyway, he was a love dog. But the question is, could somebody who ran a puppy mill be prosecuted under this statute now? Mr. Gardner.
I'm not sure exactly what your question is. Are you suggesting, Representative Bloom, through the chair, that that the puppy mill necessarily involves more than five animals, and that there's a finding of liability for failing to care for those animals and causing the injuries in the statute?
Well, which I'm talking, and it's not a well thought out question, and maybe I should. I'm going to withdraw the question.
Well, let me ask it, because I've been thinking about it. Puppy mills are notorious for creating as many dogs as possible, and as a result of creating as many dogs as possible, inbreeding them to get the confirmation that a person is looking for, you invariably produce animals that have serious defects. Now, you have a choice. It's not a very sellable animal, and you are therefore going to do what a puppy mill owner would do and either sell it off for $20 or destroy it. By having five or more animals that you're going to destroy, are you affected then by House Bill 179? Or does it depend completely on how you destroy the animals?
Chairman Gatto, I think it depends on how you destroy the animals. I think if a person took a .22 revolver and shot five animals, promptly killing them, that would not be a crime in the state of Alaska. It might be a civil penalty if you did it to someone else's property, i.e. animal, but if you shot the five dogs, it wouldn't be a crime. If you decided that you no longer wanted to care for them and you didn't have the somehow or another elected to just leave them in a pen out back for until they clawed their way at the pen and they slowly died, prolonged pain and suffering, then I think you could be charged with the felony for sure. But I think, sadly, I suspect an execution of the five puppies would not result in any kind of criminal charge.
And I can't help but agree with you there. But what if they simply had puppies that had defective limbs, unable to walk or even sit correctly?
Blindness.
Most of us would say, that's a horrible thing to do to an animal, but the alternative is to kill it. So if you decide not to kill it, even though it's pretty much unsellable and you care for it in a minimal way, but the animal is suffering nonetheless, are you now guilty of what 179 is talking about?
Chair Gatto, my response to that is that you're starting to get into some areas of some prosecutorial discretion. I'm guessing that's what Ms. Carpinetti would say if she were here. I would say that in order for a crime to occur, there has to be some causation, and I think that I think if somebody deliberately bred an animal to create a prolonged suffering situation, maybe there's a fact pattern there where they had a mental state and an act, and those things, and there was causation that led to the deformed animal and the suffering. That might be one thing, but I would think there would be a very difficult to prosecute something like that, because I don't know how you would. It would be very difficult to prove that you set about to have those things happen. So I think there'd be a causation problem, and I think a prosecutor would screen that case out.
Well, I'm going to get off in left field here, but whenever you breed, let's say you're breeding for a white coat, but in breeding for a white coat, what you're trying to do is combine recessive genes in the same animal, which produces a snowy white coat. But recessive genes in combination also produce certain diseases, and they produce certain limb lengths, and they produce possible blindness, and they produce liver failure or copper toxicology. That's the end result. That's why in the wild, where you don't select for a certain part, these animals pass away and those genes pass with them, and it's difficult to collect two recessive genes on the same trait because they've usually been, for the most part, eliminated from wild stocks. But when a person is a breeder, you are almost certain to bring together those pairs of recessive genes that are incredibly harmful, in the hopes of getting a dog that weighs 8 pounds, which is what you're after. But in the process, you wind up with organ failures and not total failures, but barely enough to keep an animal alive. And if they eat too much cheese, then they'll die, and it's not a comfortable death. So I'm not sure I want you to answer it, but I just wanted to bring up that a breeder doesn't intend to produce defective dogs, but it is a certainty that that's what will happen. Does that make the breeder a person who intentionally created defective animals?
Chairman Gatto, I think that's a tough question that would turn on whether or not that there was expert testimony from a veterinarian that would support support the idea that the person had acted essentially negligently by either failing to perceive a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result would occur, or that the circumstance exists, and that it was a gross, that failure to do so was a gross deviation from the standard of conduct a reasonable person would observe in the situation. And I think all I can do is fall back to the criminal negligence mental state and just say to you that I think that that type of a case would become a very technical case relying on expert testimony, and I would just leave my remarks there.
Well, that's the issue we have with puppy mills, is that their goal is to produce a certain conformity in an animal, and as a result they get a whole lot of others that they sell off. And as Representative Gruenberg said, sometimes you buy one that looks cute as a button but has all kinds of inherent diseases and inherent structural deformities that show up about age one as they reach their full maturity. And I don't expect you to kind of tell us what will happen in every case, but I did want to put it on the record that I do have serious concern with puppy mills, because my background is biology. We did a lot of breeding with, of all things, Drosophila flies. You produce flies with no wings. You produce blind flies. You produce a lot of things you're not looking for. That's what happens when you try to cheat Mother Nature, I suppose. Okay. Anybody, any more questions from the committee here?
Just, Mr. Chairman, you're just bringing back lots of memories
stuff
from freshman year college biology. Long wing, short wing fruit flies.
Drosophila melanogaster. I don't know why
red-eyed,
it sticks
wide-eyed
in my head.
Well, takes me back.
I'm not a history major, but I got my darn biology down. Okay, so committee, I think I'd like to move this bill out of committee. Unless we have some additional questions, would somebody like to make a motion to move House Bill 179 onward? Representative Thompson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that House Bill 179, version 27-LS0567-A, be moved from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero physical notes.
Okay, Representative Lynn, do you have an objection?
I have no objection. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As long as I don't have to say words.
Anyone else have an objection?
Just for the purpose of correction, the physical notes are indeterminate.
Okay. Oh, that was the start.
That's another issue we're having on some other bills. But okay, so seeing and hearing no objection, 179 moves from committee. That brings us down to House Bill 88, which has had a certain amount of discussion in the previous committee hearings. Bring that one in front here. Let me take a brief at ease so we can sign away. Back on the record. We have before us committee substitute for House Bill 88, Use of Foreign Law. For the record, we did adopt a CS. And for the record, we have already had public testimony, which brings it, unless we have additional people that need to talk, we do have an amendment offered by Representative Keller. Representative Keller?
I'm on Amendment Number 1.
Representative Keller moves Amendment Number 1. Here it comes.
All right.
Line 28 adds words after the word law currently established in Alaska statute or case law. And I just am thinking that will eliminate any. It's basically a grandfather clause. If there's something that's already incorporated, like canon law, into our sessions. So the intent is to go from this point forward. It has to be conceptual because it was on the fly. But
okay, I'm going to give us another minute to digest the content of Amendment Number 1, and then I will ask after a minute to see if there's an objection, and we'll proceed from there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
This is one of these very short amendments that may have some significant ramification. I would prefer, since we do have some people, and I don't even know who's on the line, that we have some discussion about this amendment, because I'm not sure I understand at all its implications, and I'm not prepared to vote. At this point, I'd like to have some testimony. I'm wondering if the folk, who do we have on the line, and if so, somebody ought to read them this amendment, or fax it to them, or email it, or something.
Well, we have Mary Ellen Beardsley, Department of Law, on the line.
Anybody else?
I don't have another person.
Well, maybe, Mr. Chair, if we could get a copy of that to Ms. Beardsley. Or do you wish to have other testimony or deal with the other thing?
I'm looking to finish this bill off today.
Of course, I understand that. Ms. Beardsley, are you there?
Through the chair, Representative Bloomberg, yes, I'm here.
Has anybody gotten you this amendment?
Through the chair, no one has sent me the amendment.
All right. Well, what it does, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Going to describe it to you, or do you want us to read it word for word, or how about just a synopsis from Representative Bloomberg?
I think, Mr. Chair, if Ms. Beardsley, if you look at the end of the bill, the definition in G, foreign law, okay, it says, and it's must have been drafted
to an
earlier version of the bill. And I think the intent is where it says on line 27 and 28, it would say, and Wes, you correct me if I'm wrong, it would just put at the end, I'm looking at the State Affairs CS, Mary Ellen. Do you have that in front of you? Version.
Yes, yes, I do.
Aye.
Aye.
Are
we? No.
Aye. In fact, this amendment is I.1.
I.1.
Oh, but I mean, which version of the
but,
bill?
But we're...
Aye.
We're on a different version of the bill?
We're on CS, which was version D is what we're using.
All right. Let me just hold everybody up here. No. Let me just go. Let me just go to Karen.
We still have to discuss the work draft I, which was adopted on Wednesday, but we haven't discussed it. So version I.
Well, we adopted it.
We adopt RD. I'm sorry. And we did adopt it, but not discuss what the changes were really.
What's our working document?
That's what we're trying to figure out.
E?
D.
D is in Delta.
D is in Delta?
D is in Delta.
Well, I've got I. It's probably... I've got M over here.
Well, I'm going to take a brief at ease because I'm still looking through this, so briefly. Judiciary is back on the record. The amendment in front of us, you'll go to page 3 of work draft for version D, and the work draft ends in territories of the United States. And if you'll look at D.1 on line 27, you'll see territories of the United States and then the amendment. Foreign law does not mean nor shall it include a law currently established in Alaska statute or case law. Representative Keller, are we on task here?
You're on task.
All right, so that's the story in front of us now. We have D.1 amending CS version D. Now, to the committee, Representative Grunberg.
Okay, Ms. Beardsley, let me tell you, if you don't have the amendment in front of you, what it will do. Do you have the D as in Delta version of the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, I do have version D, as in Delta.
You have the amendment D.1.
No.
Okay, let me just dictate the sentence to you, and you can pencil it in, and we'll try to get a copy to you there. Quote, it adds a sentence, quote, foreign law, close quote, does not mean, nor shall it include, a law currently established in Alaska statute or case law, period. So, and the term foreign law is in quotes. That sentence will be added. It is a conceptual amendment offered by Representative Keller. And so that you have it in front of you, and you heard Representative Keller, I think maybe I'll defer to you, Representative Keller, so you can explain it to her, and then my question to her is what her interpretation would be.
Yeah, through the chair, the intent is to make it a grandfather clause, make this, you know, this law effective on for statute and case law that happens from this date forward. The reason I brought it forward is because we were approached. You heard testimony the committee did in the last meeting of some concern with canon law, and the concern, as I understand it, and I confess that it was on the fly that I got the information. They were concerned that canon law is currently being applied in Alaska statute or case law. And so this seemed like an easy way to go from this point forward. So would you respond, please?
So the chair, Representative Keller, I would actually prefer to have a little more time to think about it if possible. The amendment is extremely broad, and my concern is, are you, at the very end of your conceptual amendment, you have the word law, and that could encompass a lot of things. So I really would like to maybe take a closer look at it and get back to you.
Okay, why don't you take a look at it? I'm going to bring up another person to talk about another part, and then we'll get back to this in just a few minutes. Peter, P-U-T-Z-I-E-R of Anchorage. Peter, are you online?
Chairman Gatto, yes, I am.
Thanks, Peter. Can you tell us, it says representing state of Alaska. What affiliation do you have inside the state of Alaska?
I'm an attorney working for the Attorney General's division.
Okay, and you're going to speak on tribal law?
Yes.
Okay, well, so we're on task here. Go ahead and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't have prepared testimony. I was available for questions. I can give you my general comments. And what I have in front of me, and so I don't know if this is what the committee has in front of it right now, but what was emailed to me yesterday was entitled Explanation of Changes from CSHB 88 Version I to Draft Version D. And I'm assuming that that's the correct version I should be addressing?
That is correct. We are all on D, and the amendment that we were dealing with Mary Ellen was D.1. And then, so if you have D in front of you, it's not amended yet, but I do not believe your testimony will get into what the amendment says. So if you have some comments, we would appreciate hearing them.
Thank you, Chairman Gatto. My assumptions were two. First, that tribal law was not the focus of this legislation, and secondly, that even if it were the focus, that this particular body is without authority to restrict the tribe's inherent authority. I suggested a couple of amendments, and it looks like in the draft that I have, those amendments may have been made. First, rather than excluding, specifically including a definition saying that foreign law does not include tribal law, I thought that was unnecessary given how foreign law is defined. It's defined in geographic terms. Those geographic terms mean that foreign law is a law outside the jurisdiction of the United States and the territories of the United States. The federally recognized tribes, and certainly the tribes in the state of Alaska, are within the jurisdiction of the United States. So the tribal laws or rules or codes are not foreign laws defined here. So I didn't think we needed to specifically call out any definition in section 3 and subsection G. There's also then, I suggested that if the committee wants to be absolutely clear that this, it does not intend to reach the issue of application of tribal law in the state, that it could consider an amendment. And what has been added is an amendment to the uncodified law, saying that, in essence, that this legislation is not intended to get into questions of tribal law or interplay between state law and tribal law. Those are my comments.
Okay, thanks. Karen, would you comment on whether or not those are that is included in version D? Am I correct?
Through the chair, my name is Karen Sawyer, and I'm staff to Representative Carl Gatto. And the explanation of changes that you see from 88 State Affairs version I to this draft 88 version D that's before you, the changes that he, Mr. Putzier, explained is in the work draft. At the bottom of page 1 is the legislative intent that he mentioned. And then we took off from the original bill, we deleted except that foreign law does not mean nor shall it include a law of an Alaska Native or Native American tribe in the state. We took that off in State Affairs and just put in the legislative intent that this does not affect tribal law.
So, Mr. Putzier, is that were you listening and understood what you had said?
Chairman Gatto, yes, and I agree with what you said.
Perfect. It's a great thing for a chairman to hear. Okay, Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Putzier, I tend to agree that this probably does the job. My only question is, you practice, obviously, in the area of Native law, and is it enough in this particular case? I suppose the answer is going to be yes, but is it enough to have it in the uncodified law? I guess that will appear then in a note, won't it? So it'll be okay, right?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I believe, yes, that will be okay. I believe that will be sufficient. I don't believe that tribal law is implicated in any event the way foreign law is defined. So for two reasons, I think it would be okay.
Thank you, Mayor.
Another question, Representative Gruenberg.
I know we have Mary Ellen Beardsley on this line also, but I know, and I know you were listening when we talked about the Keller Amendment. Were you paying enough attention to know where it goes and what it is? Because I'd like to ask you your opinion as well of about the Keller Amendment. Do you want me to read it to you again?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I wrote it out as follows. Foreign law, in quotes, does not mean nor shall it include a law currently established under Alaska statute or case law.
In Alaska statute or case law, it'd be the same thing. It's a conceptual amendment. That's right. And I would ask, with the chair's permission, your opinion on that as well.
Yes, well, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I tend to agree with Ms. Beardsley that this is potentially complicated. I question, for example, what about Alaska regulations and what about laws from other states? Do we have to call out then why just Alaska law? Why not Washington law or Alabama law? I think that this section would have to be scrutinized a little bit more closely to make sure it doesn't have any unintended consequences. I guess my initial thought was that it could have some unintended consequences. I would have to learn more about the concern about application of canon law before, I guess, completing my thought on that. But in short, I guess I have concerns. I'm not prepared beyond that to say whether or not, you know, what the long-term ramifications might be.
Okay, thank you. Representative Keller has a question.
Just a Because I'm still grappling with the meaning of my own amendment here, are you aware of any place where canon law is currently incorporated into Alaska statute in any way? I mean, I mean, are you aware of any? Can you come up with any scenario where this may be appropriate to include this exemption or this grandfather clause?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I am not, but that's why I say I think I would have to get more background about the concern about canon law. I don't know enough about the underlying concern to address that more clearly, and I apologize.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, and Representative Keller can correct me if I misheard him, but I thought I heard that part of the attempt here was to make sure that we don't have problems with canon law and Jewish law. Did I hear you that correctly?
I said canon law.
Canon law. And so I was curious if, I would think that because canon law is not, to the best of my knowledge, contained in Alaska statutes or case law, that this actually wouldn't accomplish well. I give great credit to Representative Keller for trying to help us out of the weeds on some of these things, but I'm just not sure we're there with this language. I was wondering if Mr. Putzer or Representative Keller could...
Representative Keller?
Thank you, Representative Lindsey. And it's pretty hard for somebody who's in the weeds to get somebody out of the weeds. I missed the last hearing. And with that, I would like to withdraw this amendment. Because I personally, after seeing it and thinking about it further, I don't think it accomplishes what I had in mind. And it is broader than I had in mind. So I would rather withdraw. So thank you.
Okay. So, Representative Keller, you withdraw amendment number one.
Yes, thank you.
Is there an objection to withdrawing amendment number one? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number one is withdrawn, which brings us back to version D. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm going to discuss this bill. If I may I have a little leeway and discuss the bill?
Just go ahead and discuss things, and we'll deal with it as it comes along.
I'm going to call it the bishop's letters. They have two letters, and Father Travers' comments on the record here, Pat Travers, caused me some concern, and finally brought back a memory. And I've mentioned this to the chair, and I've mentioned this to Representative Holmes, but not to the rest of you. A horrendous case I had in private practice, if I may recite that, Mr. Chairman.
Recite it. Thank you.
I was called by a woman in Anchorage in a trailer. Her mother was there, and her husband had a knife to her throat and had raped her. And the police were called, and they ultimately arrested him. It was large news in Anchorage. And he was convicted of rape and sent away in prison term for 10 years. We had to do quite a bit to make certain that he could not locate the mom and the little boy. All contact would be through a post office box. The family was Orthodox Jewish. And he was an Israeli. Under Orthodox law, rabbinic law, in order to remarry, you have to get an Orthodox divorce. It's called a get, and in English it's G-E-T. And it has to be given by a rabbinic tribunal, and they had to go to Seattle to get this. But the key thing is that under that rabbinic law, the wife can't obtain it unless the husband agrees. And the husband was in jail for raping the wife and was unwilling to agree to allow her to get a rabbinic divorce again. It was in Superior Court, and needless to say, nobody was aware of any case that had been like this in Alaska, and it's just coincidental that I was there and I'm here today. There are some cases in New York mainly,
but there are from other jurisdictions, and I did a lot of research on this. The question is whether the secular civil court has authority to make the man agree to allow the wife to get a get. And this has tortured the thinking of a lot of, I mean, it's made it difficult in a number, they're difficult decisions, because the charge is, of course, the separation of church and state, and the man saying, I have a right to practice my religion, and under my religion, I have a right to refuse to let my wife get a divorce. We did the briefing, and ultimately the case settled, and the whole case resolved itself, and he signed it eventually. But my concern is, with the bill in any form here, that the defense could be raised by an Orthodox husband that he has a constitutional right to practice his religion and refuse to allow the wife to get a divorce. And in this case, it maybe was a paradigm example of how that could create a terrific injustice. And that was a concrete example, and I just happened to have been the lawyer involved with that. And the second thing I wanted to mention is it was 40 years ago that I took conflict of laws. And I managed to contact my professor yesterday. He's in his late 70s. He lives in Seattle. I went to UCLA Law School, and it was in his first year of teaching. And I think this was the first time he had taught it. And I located Henry W. McGee. And Mr. McGee now teaches at Seattle University Law School, where Representative Gatto's daughter just graduated from fairly recently. And he said he hasn't taught conflict of laws in a long time. He's going to try to get the name of a professor, and at some point in hearing somewhere on this bill, we'll try to find a professor who can talk about the effect of this bill on conflict of laws. But I happened to have these two volumes I bring my horn books and stuff down. This was my textbook 40 years ago, and this is the horn book. But this is a body of law, conflict of laws, involving forum non-convenience and venue and choice of law, and judgments is the third area. And it's all judge-made law. And it's not statutory at all. And the rules are fairly complicated if you're dealing with property. It's the law of the situs, where it's the land is. If it's a law of the validity of a marriage, it's where the marriage is celebrated. If it's a contract and you're talking about the way the conflict was written, it's the law where it was written. If you're talking about performance, it's the law where the contract is performed. And then there's the center of gravity, choice of law approaches, and there are a bunch of cases on that. But the thing about this law, it will have a terrific effect on a lot of judge-made law, and a lot of it's international, and it's a very complicated area. It's usually one of the most difficult courses in law school reserved for seniors, and that's what we're getting into. And I have great affection and respect for the sponsor of the bill here, but this is not an easy thing. Thank you for letting me digress.
Okay. Karen Sawyer?
Thank you. I'm Karen Sawyer, staff to Representative Gatto. I just want to speak to an email that I got from Janet Levy, who spoke to her attorneys about the decision about the canon law and Jewish law, et cetera. And she said from her attorneys that this bill does not touch church decisions or mosque decisions, and the reason is because the First Amendment does not allow it to under the abstention doctrine. The Supreme Court has made clear that under the First Amendment, such intra-church mosque synagogue disputes remain internal unless neutral principles of law can be applied. This bill does not and cannot usurp federal First Amendment law. So that was the statement that was sent to me about that.
Are you saying that religious practice from an almost unheard of religion that allows for torture would take precedent over House Bill 88?
Through the chair, I believe this is just dealing with the internal covenants of the church or synagogue or whatever, that law that deals with that church or monastery or whatever, not about, you know, criminal or civil issues that would necessarily have to go to secular law. They're just talking about the internal things
Well, what if there's a conflict between secular law and religious law? I mean, that's what the bill is about. It's that, here's what stands in first place, is the laws of the state. And if you have a conflict with the religious law...
Through the chair, actually, this bill doesn't deal with religious law. This is dealing with the civil law, that of foreign law, that some of them are associated, intertwined with religious law. So we're dealing with just the civil portion of the law.
Okay. Questions? Representative Grunberg?
I think, and it's difficult for me to know what some lawyer, through the client, through the letter, through reading and just hearing about it, it's difficult, but I think if the members would look at the second letter from the bishops, dated the 1st of April, there is a synopsis of an article taken from a newspaper that discusses apparently how judges in another state are dealing with this. I think that puts things in perspective. What I would say, only thing I would say, folks, is this is extremely complicated, and the judges have to look at all of these different sets of laws and put them together into the case, how they apply. And it's really not an area, in my opinion, that lends itself to a statute which is short and can't fit a lot of these factual things. It's got to be done. The case law develops, common law develops, based upon individual fact situations, and they're all fact driven. And the principles, whether they're equitable principles or choice of law principles or whatever, contractual principles, they are all designed to make the legal system work. And it's not an area, it's not like running government. It's private disputes we're dealing with here. And to come out with a short statute, it's in the classical sense procrusty, and you're trying to get procrustes to fit the bed, and it doesn't really work very well.
Isn't that why we have judges? I mean, if everything was simple, we wouldn't need them.
That's why we have judges, and that's why this is a judge-made system.
Okay. So when the question of the House Bill 88 comes up, maybe a judge is going to have to say, but it allows for that, and otherwise we wouldn't need them. Representative Keller?
I just want to say something similar. I mean, we don't have to be seniors in law school in order to write laws. I mean, this describes a preference that the legislature, non-professional lawyers that we may be, that is pretty clear, and that is that the court should not use law that does not come through by means of our Constitution, and there may be complexities there, but I'm ready to move the bill.
I kind of had a goal of moving it by 2:30 so we can get to one last bill. Representative Lynn?
I just wanted to make one comment. I have this very nice letter from Alaska Catholic Conference of Bishops, and I should disclose that I am, in fact, a practicing Catholic, but there's nothing in this letter that prohibits me from voting any way I want on this legislation.
Okay.
And I intend to vote yes on the legislation, by the way, because I think it's kind of a duh thing. We follow American law.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to associate myself with pretty much everything that's been said by my good friend, Representative Grunberg, today. I think he's brought up some very, very troubling points for me, and the letter from the bishops brings up another troubling point to me. I'm worried about the intersection of this. We're trying to do something kind of interesting here, it appears, from the committee discussion. It appears we're trying to protect certain types of religious law while outlawing other types of religious law. And that's troubling to me, both from a legal standpoint of how you draw that line to protect canon law and Jewish law while outlawing Sharia law, is the testimony I've been hearing. That creates both legal questions for me as well as ethical and moral questions for me. That's my first objection. My second problem with the bill is the stuff that is the topics that I brought up and discussed quite extensively on Wednesday, which are the fact that this is a very complicated area of law that I believe has great consequences for international business, for Alaska's reputation as a place for people to want to do business, as well as complicating our choice of law in individual cases. I think it's going to open up a whole can of worms in trying to protect against something that is not actually happening in our courts now. Sharia law is not being used in our courts. We did extensive research in our office across the country, a Westlaw search on the topic of Sharia law, and what we found time and again was whenever it was brought up, judges were saying, no, we're not going to apply that. People were arguing that it should be applied, and the judges were saying, no, we apply our laws and our constitution. And so the courts are doing what they ought to be doing and applying the correct sets of laws in the correct circumstances. And in trying to protect against that, which I don't actually think we need protection against because I think that's what our constitution and our laws and our judges already do, I think we are unwittingly creating a whole host of problems in conflict of law and international business issues. And so I am going to be a do not pass on this bill.
My fairly long lifespan, I've discovered that judges sometimes absolutely amaze me. Right. And I could give you at least a couple of instances that for the rest of my life will just baffle me how they could conceivably have reached that decision. But they did. And I think they were dead wrong. Anybody I've talked to would agree they were dead wrong. So judges can make a rule. Once they make it, suddenly we have certain allowances. People then back refer back to them. What we want to do is clarify things. And I worry mostly about, make sure I get the right words here. There are enough instances in history where they said, we don't need that. And I'll take it all the way back to World War II when Chamberlain said, peace in our time. We don't have to worry about those Germans and Czechoslovakia. We know little about them, and we're not concerned about them. History major. And so they gave them Czechoslovakia, and there came World War II. There are other instances of the same thing where we say, we don't need this. And in England, they didn't need any protection, and now they have two sets of laws. And there's a lot of Englishmen that are absolutely half crazy that they have two sets of laws in England. We didn't need these concerns until it was too late, where we needed them and didn't know it. So I'm going to let Representative Thompson finish, and then we're going to bring this bill up. Yeah,
my biggest concern was following up on Representative Holmes. House Bill 88, this is the letter from Department of Law, that House Bill 88 might affect a foreign entity's willingness to do business with individuals or businesses in Alaska if it knows that provisions of the contract might be void by law should House Bill 88 become law. I think that might hurt us economically as far as individuals trying to deal with somebody even in the state of Oregon or California and trying to deal with them through business individually. They find out that they're not going to have to be under Alaska law. It could hurt us economically. The other thing is that I back on this bill is that we've got to make sure that we don't have foreign law starting to take over what's going on in the United States. Through our research here in the last few days, we found real estate agencies in the state of Texas that advertise that they're writing real estate contracts under Sharia law. That kind of bothers me that we don't want to have that happen up here. So it's got a twofold mix on it here that I'm kind of...
Well, I read that part where it says, you know, if an individual enters into a contract with a foreign corporation. That's kind of a rare event where you have an individual who's not a corporation entering into a contract with a foreign corporation. I could see individual and individuals, but I mean, if I want to go and probably have China make me some special gun container, my guess is I'm probably going to be a corporation. It's easy to do that. Representative Holmes, I'm going to give you the last word here, and then we're going to vote.
I was just going to address that point in that actually when you say contract, first of all, there are employment contracts, which I think are fairly frequent, but also contracts are a lot of things. It's not for instance, if you go on a foreign cruise or you go on vacation, and you know, you have entered often into contractual obligations with foreign entities. There, when you buy things online, there are all sorts, yes, of things that are considered contracts, even though you know they aren't what you think of as a big contract. It's not a negotiation between, you're right, it wouldn't be as likely for me, Lindsay, to enter into a big agreement with a multinational corporation and negotiate it one-on-one. It happens, and there would be employment contracts and things like that that might fall under those. But you are considered to have a contract with a lot of companies, even if you don't think of it, when you buy a ticket for an airline, when you buy when you stay in a hotel, when you contract to go on a cruise, when you buy all sorts of when you buy products from foreign manufacturers, and the warranties, all of that. That's all contract law that may be between an individual and a foreign corporation, even though we don't think of it that way. So that's simply my.
Okay, well taken, partner. Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would ask that you would allow me to read just one phrase from the Constitution here. Paragraph 2, Article 6, this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of the state to the contrary notwithstanding. I struggle with the same thing that Representative Thompson actually addressed. I'm afraid there are some issues here that obviously our Department of Law has spoken about relating to our relationship with individuals and companies outside of our state. But at the same time, whether it's Sharia, whether it's rabbinic law like we talked about today, or even canon law, in the end, the supreme law of this land is the law that we have put in place as either a country or as a state. And that's where I struggle with this, is I do not want to find ourselves in a England situation where we have dual law, where we have two separate codes that people can find themselves convicted under. But at the same time, I struggle with the fact that in this bill, we could be missing a few things. And cutting ourselves off, I think we heard in testimony the other day that there are times already where there could be law that is applied in Alaska that can be used in our court system that is actually from somewhere else, and it's usually because of a contract that has been made or some sort of business relationship, and that by putting this forward, we could affect things that I don't think we're intending to affect. And maybe we need to, maybe if our intent is to have our law be the supreme law and not allow some other law, whether it's Sharia or something else, to kind of take over, which I think is the concept behind this, we might need to spend a little bit more time making sure we're not also disrupting our business opportunities and economic opportunities with places outside of Alaska. So it is a true conundrum that I'm in, that I mirror Representative Thompson's discussion as well. And so with that, I think we're about to vote. I'm still not sure how I'm going to vote on this.
Representative Keller had a final comment.
Become a student in a complex area in 3 minutes and read the first sentence of Representative Grunberg's book here. It occurred to me that the law very explicitly talks about applying foreign law. And the very first definition, when you're talking about conflicts of law, it's the complexities come in when you're considering, and the judge determining when he considers what, you know, the So I can surely understand the complexities. They're way over my head. I do not pretend to understand, but I do applying it. May allow for consideration. It does not ban consideration.
Karen Sorey?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, I just wanted to point out that in the work draft, D, it does say on page 2, line 28, this section does not apply to a corporation, partnership, or other form of business association, and that was done in state affairs because of the concern about that was raised in the Attorney General's letter. And also, I just wanted to point out that in Texas, there's already a Sharia court in place. So,
and many times, I have a lot of years behind me, and we've seen situations that we had to make a choice. The definition of a dilemma is a choice between two undesirables. And unfortunately, sometimes you have no choice. You're going to pick one or the other. And I've always picked the one that had the best, most favorable long-term effect rather than this one that could give me more of an instant gratification. And my concern, and the reason why HB 88 is there, is the long-term effect that I would certainly like to avoid. So with that, Representative Keller.
I'd like to move House Bill 88, LS0333 Delta, the committee with individual recommendations and what is it, attached zero?
It has an indeterminate fiscal note.
Indeterminate fiscal note.
We have an objection. We're going to take the roll.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Gruber?
Yes.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Representative Keller?
Yes.
Representative Pruitt?
Yes.
Representative Gotham?
Yes.
Representative
Groomer?
Yes.
Thank you. With that, HB 88 moves from committee, and let's take a brief at ease. We have before us a great number, House Bill 1, which the prime sponsor is me.
That seems to be a thing.
So I will let
there'd be a lot of that going around.
So, excuse me, Karen Sawyer, would you help me out of this quagmire and deal with House Bill 1? Or they think that it's all about me today.
We think skits have started today.
Actually. Good afternoon.
I'm fine too, you see.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Good afternoon. My name is Karen Sawyer, and I am staff to the prime sponsor, me, also known as Representative Gatto. This is about Alaska Health Freedom Act, and this bill is really about states' rights. We allege that the new federal law that was passed last year, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, also known as PPACA, infringes upon the constitutional rights of U.S. individuals by mandating that all citizens and legal residents have qualifying health care coverage or pay a tax penalty. By imposing such a mandate, this law exceeds the powers of the United States under the Constitution. Congress does not have the authority to regulate inactivity under Commerce Clause. We're not challenging the federal court or federal government. They've challenged our authority as a state, and it's up to us to defend ourselves. If we don't, this is just the beginning of more federal takeover. This bill will codify a state policy that every person in the state of Alaska is and shall continue to be free from federal government force in the selection of health insurance options, and that such liberty is protected by the constitutions of the United States and the state of Alaska. The bill also removes the authority of any state official or employee from enforcing any penalty which violates the policy. We affirm that the right of all Alaskans to choose their own mode of securing health care services. Now, there has been a question in the past on page 1, line 12, and you should have an explanation in front of you, some examples of what that is, and I'll read that. It says, does not apply to health care services provided or required by the state, a political subdivision of the state, or a court of the state, and may not impair a contract right that provides health care services. And this basically is regarding people that are, for example, in the Department of Correction, or dealing with a spouse who's liable for the necessary expenses of another spouse, including medical treatment or health care services. It deals with the duties of a parent or a guardian in the determination for their minors. It doesn't include the screening of newborns for hereditary or congenital disorders. There's a number of, I've got nine here as examples, Workers' Compensation Act, physical and mental examination of a party ordered by a judge. So that's what is that's what's under on line 12, number one. There right now there's at least 40 states that have introduced legislation to limit, alter, or oppose the selected federal actions, including the mandates that would require purchase of insurance. And right now we have Virginia, Arizona, Utah, Idaho, Georgia, Louisiana, and Missouri. And there's, I believe, just this last month, North Carolina was added to that list of the states that have passed this. And I also have, you have in front of you a CS from HES committee, and I want, and there's an explanation of changes that was from the original bill to the HES bill. Is everybody with me? Okay. And what that is on the last, second page.
Where's the sectional that's showing the changes? There we go.
Okay, the second page of the CS from HES committee talks about penalty on line 8. And the explanation for this change was that there was a concern from one of the members that if a person decided under this bill that he didn't have to purchase insurance, that he was just going to pay for his own health care services, what if that person saw this bill and it said that he was going to be penalized, or that he could be penalized under PPACA? And so this penalty means it does not include the liability for paying for their own health care services. Mm-hmm. So that clarified that concern. Does that make sense? And I don't have anything else. Thank you very much.
Hands are flying.
Yeah.
All right. PPACA, Patient Protection Affordable.
Patient Protection Affordable Care Act.
Got it. Representative Holmes.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. First, you pointed out this this list that we have of things that it doesn't include. Where did this list come from?
Well, actually, that. Through the chair, Representative Holmes, that list actually came from one of the other states that have passed, and we did not create our own list to include with this bill, but these are examples that are used under that same line that they're using, just to explain different state.
Okay, so I guess my follow-up questions are all about, I think, about these lines, this lines 12 and 13 on page 1, trying to figure out what this means. Okay, I'll ask a slightly different question first. What about a private employer, for instance? I mean, obviously, it seems to be at least intending not to get, if the state's requiring it, a political subdivision. But what if, say, I'm a private employer, at a Holdman, or I've got a small number, let's say, a small number of employees, and in order to get a decent deal on health insurance, I have to have all the employees in my company enrolled in order to get the low enough rate, and I want to require one of my employees to be covered by my insurance.
And to pay for it, or just to be covered?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, those are both of those are questions. I mean, if I require you as a to be employed, either, you know, to be enrolled, which theoretically is sort of part of your employment package and probably has some trade-off with salary and other benefits, either to make you explicitly pay a portion of it or implicitly, you know, at least be enrolled, would that be illegal under this?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, the whole point of this bill is that a person has the right to choose. And so that person, under that situation, I believe, would have the choice to, you know, to either accept it or not accept it, whether the employer wanted him to or not, because that would be his choice.
Good scenario is my wife has a fabulous job. She's covered. I'm covered. The kids are covered. Grandma's covered. We're all covered. 100%, it's that good a job she has. And then I'm offered, my employer offers me a health care package, which I don't need, but is going to require me to pay for it, and I decline. Because I want to decline.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's what HB1 deals with. If you want to decline, you can.
I'm just trying to figure out what is
Representative Gruenberg?
I had a whole list, but we can go back and forth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way this is written causes me a question. This could literally be used in family law. A parent could say, for whatever reason, they could say religious or whatever, I decline to treat my child. I'll just do it through prayer. And the kid's going to die. And in those circumstances, quite often the court would appoint a guardian ad litem and would determine what's in the child's best interest and might order the parent to provide medical treatment for the child to save the child's life, a little baby. And might even appoint a guardian ad litem to represent the child's best interest. And potentially, penalty here looks like a financial penalty. I don't know that they would necessarily do this. They would probably direct the state to intervene and put the child in the state's custody and something like that. But it's conceivable for some reason a judge might choose to order the parent to do it and impose a monetary sanction. And I'm concerned that this could potentially endanger a child.
You mean to pay for the emergency room and treatment and intensive care? By requiring the parent to, since they shouldn't have health care, to pay those bills, and they don't have the money.
No, I'm not suggesting. I'm assuming that, no, I'm not talking if they don't have the money. No. I'm talking about go down to Costco and purchase the drug. Parent just says, no, I'm going to I just don't believe that the child should take drugs. I mean, I'm holistic or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to be constrained by a what if, but I want something. I can understand this is kind of basically saying we should be free to purchase private insurance and not have to do it through a governmental organization. I mean, that's basically what's going on here. But I don't want this to be misinterpreted so that somebody could say, aha, under this new law, you can't make me pay or you can't fine me if I don't.
I think there's a conflict here. The requirement to care for your youngsters is a stronger issue than you can choose not to buy it, but that doesn't remove your requirement to care for youngsters. And you could say, well, I didn't buy it, so now I don't have the insurance and I don't have the money. I think that's a pretty different issue from what the bill is talking about.
You're not intending to get to that in this, but you're not trying to trump the child's best interest here.
Absolutely not. And if indeed that's what's going on, we'll modify the bill. Let me go to Representative Keller.
I just want to be sure that
yeah.
we don't.
Yeah, I just want to point out that the what you choose and decline is on page 10, or page 1, line 10. It's the any mode of obtaining health care services is what the option is for. Any mode of obtaining.
That's defined on page 2.
And it's defined on page 2. And you, in your description, said choose or decline treatment.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you want to make it clear that the definition does not include treatment.
I'm not sure exactly what the word would be, but at this point I'm just expressing a concern.
Yeah. I don't know. If you just won the lottery, you don't have to buy health insurance, but you cannot decline treatment to your child based on your religious views when they need a liter of blood and they're dead without the liter of blood.
And there, by the way, there's another statute, and Sarah pointed it out, talks about treating through spiritual means, and we'd have to take a look at that. We dealt with that in House Bill 150 in the sphere of elder care. So I just want to be sure
that at this point we don't.
In my experience as a paramedic, we dealt with this in street medicine. People said the elders of the church were there. I forgot the church, but elders of the church were there. We had a woman who delivered a baby, a lot of bleeding, too much bleeding, pasty, pale, low blood pressure, fast pulse, all things saying, better do something. And we said, we're going to give her an IV. And they said, no blood. Well, we don't have blood. So we gave her lactated ringers. That worked just fine. She recovered nicely. But they said no blood. In the hospital, wouldn't matter what they said. If the woman's going to be in jeopardy without blood, they'll give it to her. And I don't know if she can decline it, but when you're already having low blood pressure and foggy, whether or not you're allowed to decline it. So that's treatment. This is really purchasing.
I'd like to speak to that through the chair, Representative Grunberg. That's one of the examples that this subsection, this act, does not apply to. And for an example, any law regarding the right or duty of a parent or guardian in the determination or provision of health care services or medical treatment for a minor. So,
okay.
So that's not going to cover that situation.
Representative Thompson.
Yes, let's, Mr. Chairman, let's go back to your example of your wife has 100% covered insurance that covers the family, but your employer has a union contract and said, we're going to hold $200 per month out of your pay for your portion of this insurance because that's the union contract. would this give you a right to decline that $200 insurance when the contract with the employer is that every employee will be insured to make sure that it all fits? Or a union employee that gets paid $35 an hour. $5 an hour goes into retirement, $5 an hour goes into medical. I know that in the past they've been able to decline the medical because their wife had 100% coverage for the family, and they were able to decline that and take that money. But now it is required that they have to have dual coverage paid for by both the spouse and the husband and the wife. Does this give them the right to decline that type of a contractual coverage with the union?
You know, I could see the union's point of view that says we don't get this rate unless we have 100% coverage.
Right.
And that means if one person can decline it, that is absorbed by all the remaining members. That certainly is an issue that has popped up in other areas, too.
Would this bill?
I believe the bill allows them to decline it.
Give them the right to decline that.
Yeah, and the union, if it is a union and they're $5, maybe have to consider 10% or 5% of the people will decline it, and let's bargain and say we don't have 100% coverage, we have 80% coverage. How much is it going to cost everybody?
Right.
And work it out. But, yeah, the bill allows you to decline it, especially when you have 100% coverage and then somebody says, hey, we've got some great coverage for you, and you'll say, I don't want it. Representative Holmes?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the back on this right to choose or decline. I'm sure this isn't the intention, but again, I'm reading here, it's a policy of the state of Alaska, a person has the right to choose or decline any mode of obtaining health care services. Let's say I work for Company A, and I look around and I say, Company B, or the unions. Man, the unions have a great health care coverage. I'm not a union member, but I want that coverage. Wouldn't this allow me to...
No, to accept or decline?
To
you can only accept it
choose.
If it's offered.
It says choose. It doesn't say accept or decline. It says choose. Wouldn't that... You know, I could say, I want Company B's or I want that union policy because they're better than mine. They got a better rate. They get more coverage. I want, even though I don't belong to that company and don't belong to that union.
Could be
one of my concerns.
Yeah, you're a lawyer and you want to get the policy from the electrical workers.
Yep.
do you have that right?
Yeah. I'm wondering in that same sort of vein whether it would allow you to allow somebody to obtain certain kinds of health care that maybe aren't considered okay in our state, use of drugs for health care services that maybe we don't condone, use of different types of surgical or other types of treatments that maybe aren't considered good public policy under the state of Alaska. Maybe you would have the right to choose a mode of obtaining health care services without penalty or threat of penalty. So I say, well, gosh, you know, I really need that illegal drug as part of my health care. I can obtain that, and you can't penalize me. You can't send me to jail for using that.
So let's get an opinion. Stacy Crayley, are you available?
Coming behind you there.
I guess you are.
Lots of chairs.
Got to give us an ID and an affiliation.
Social Security number.
My name is Stacy.
And your health care plan.
State of Alaska. My name is Stacy Crayley, and I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. I work in the civil division. Through the chair, Representative Holmes, if, I guess you had two questions there, and I'm trying to keep track of where we are. So you had one question about choose or decline and accept, and then you followed that up with a follow-on about whether or not if you wanted to, well, can you repeat your question to make sure I'm on the right page here?
And if I could throw in Representative Thompson's question, we'll just get them all out.
We'll just collect them into all the different versions. We'll meet here and we'll put them together. Go ahead.
So I guess the three questions I heard on are looking at lines 8 through 10, whether or not it would give somebody, for instance, a union member, and maybe the collective bargaining has said that all members will pay X amount and everybody will be enrolled in the health care coverage. Would it allow somebody to basically and decline that coverage?
Mm-hmm.
Number two, would it allow somebody, for instance, outside the union to come in and say, or somebody outside a given company to have a right to try to enroll in a health care plan that they're not otherwise mm-hmm. qualified for? Question number three, might it allow people to engage in certain forms of health care, illegal drugs or other types of treatment that we might consider against public policy without penalty or threat of penalty? So even if it's something that might otherwise be criminalized in this state or not legal, would this potentially be in conflict with some of our laws in that arena?
I'll give you a few seconds to...
Yeah, there's a lot there.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Holmes, first let me qualify that I do not, my area of expertise, assuming I have one, is not in union contracts or coverage issues in the insurance arena and that sort of thing. So qualifying my answers with that large caveat, I think you make a very good point about how this is drafted on line 9 regarding the... person who has the right to quote-unquote choose or decline, and I think choose has a different connotation as to accept, and so I think that's something that should be evaluated in that context. I think when you have an option to choose, you can say yes or no to, you know, kind of what you're arguing, that somebody could go to employer A versus employer B and say, I like your policy better than my and I want to choose that policy. And I think the intent of this bill, if I may, and the chairman can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the idea is that if you were offered offered an insurance plan, you can say yes or no. So I think that choose might be a little too broad in that context.
Accept or decline any health care policy offered.
Offered, and I think that
and
would.
I think we need that.
That would solve that first question that you raised. And I think it kind of goes to the second question, too. I think as to your question about illegal health care, I think that I don't necessarily think that that is contemplated in the issue here, because I think that the definitions under C1 and 3 would preclude you from using health care services that were not authorized in this state, and or the penalty that is proposed here is a fine or a penalty for failing to secure health care, not for for failing to secure basically insurance coverage. And if that, and I think that's the intent of the bill is to say, if you choose not to obtain health care insurance of some sort, that you cannot be penalized in some form or fashion for not having health care. If you want to be a private pay for the rest of your life, that's your choice. And I think, although I think your question raises some points and we should look at it to make sure we've addressed that, I don't think that's the intent of this bill, and I think that the provisions of how the sections are defined in paragraph C on page 2, both as to what healthcare services include and then also the penalty provisions of it. And by making that change also on line 9, I think that would solve that problem.
Line 9 on page 1.
Yeah, where you change the accept. Yeah.
Choose becomes accept, and health any insurance. Mode means any mode offered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of a health insurance policy. And I think then that gets to the part about what's covered or not covered is governed by those policies.
Got it. Representative Holmes.
Thanks. Mr. Chairman, I got it. And I don't quibble with the fact that that's not the intent. I know that's not the intent of the bill. I'm trying to figure out what it does, and I'm not sure.
No, we need to deal with the language.
Yeah, the language.
Intent is one thing, but the language is more important.
I think none of the hypotheticals we brought up are necessarily going into the intent, but that's the whole point of the Judiciary Committee is to make sure intent and reality line up. So I think we might still need to tweak Section C. I had two more things to throw on the table, Mr. Chairman, if I may. One question is, would this law apply, obviously the Affordable Care Act, I would assume, is what this is sort of going towards. Would this apply to other federal laws?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, I suppose that it could apply to other federal laws that address this particular issue, should they be brought forward, passed, and implemented. So yeah, I think it potentially could. I don't think it's exclusively tagged to or tasked to the Affordable Care Act, but I think that that's the current state of the law, if you will, at the federal level.
Can you explain that a little bit further? Were we getting ourselves off in an unusual direction when you talked about federal law? And in other words, the question I would have is, we can decline any form, including that offered by the federal government, that offered by the company I work for, that offered by a stranger or a company. Did I miss something?
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't think you've missed anything. I think the way the bill is drafted is it doesn't matter if it's offered by the federal government or a private employer or the state government or whomever, that you have the right to accept or decline that coverage.
I think it does. Mr. Chairman, I think subsection B excludes anything through the state.
B?
I think B1 does not apply to health care services provided or required by the state. That state health care insurance would fall under the exemption. I think if it's offered by the state or the muni, it's actually explicitly exempted.
Stuck with it?
I stand corrected through the chair, Representative Holmes. Subparagraph B would exclude services provided by the state or policies offered by the state or a political subdivision of the state of Alaska.
Karen?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, would on page 2, line 2, if we inserted legal service or treatment, would that be more acceptable?
Say it again.
Do you think? The question had been about illegal drugs, et cetera. And on page 2, line 2, if we inserted legal, the word legal, before service or treatment, or somewhere in there, if that would make a difference.
Stacy. Hey, you're the Attorney General person.
Yeah, that's not saying much. Through the chair again, Representative Holmes. I don't know if that, the problem I have with that, I think it's a good start and something to be evaluated. Legal has... if we're trying to address the concern of somebody wanting to say, I want to get my health care services, this all goes back to line 10, where you're looking at the mode of obtaining health care services, whereas if what you're trying to do is authorize individuals to decline or accept the ability to be insured to pay for these services, that they can be private pays, I think clarifying what health care services are is maybe not as important as clarifying the point that you're trying, that I believe that you're trying to get to here, which is to allow individuals to choose not to be to pay for health care insurance, to not be required to have health care insurance.
And my spouse is retired, and she is entitled to medical insurance, but just to pay. And I said, the heck with it. You're covered under me. Why don't we just pass on that? So even though it's state, I think it's state, yeah, state offered, she was able to decline it. Or decline that portion that she would have to pay, which is the same thing as declining it. Karen?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chair, the PPACA, the Affordable Act, is dealing with just making sure that everybody has insurance. And it's a mandate that if you don't have it, take insurance, then you get penalized. So what we're trying to do, I mean, if you're offered two different insurances, you're not required under PPACA to take both of them. The PPACA's concern is that you have insurance.
Yeah, but they set the minimum standards for it too.
Right, and our concern is that, you know, we don't want the federal government telling us that we have to do something, and if we don't, then they're going to fine us for inactivity.
Equal to the amount that it would have cost you.
I've got from PPACA, it starts off with $695 per year, and then it goes up every year. So by 2016, it's like it just incrementally just goes up.
In the
it's
beginning.
So they have that set out.
Representative Thompson?
Yeah, I think that my question about the unions and employment contracts for making you get your insurance is probably covered under B2. May not impair a contract right that provides health care service. I assume that probably would be covering the union contract or employment contract for you would be required basically with the contract to have the insurance and pay $100 or $200.
Before we forget, I'm going to move that we change choose to accept and add offered, the word offered, as a conceptual amendment that was
after the word any.
I put it on line 10 on page 1, and that's why it's conceptual when it says any mode of obtaining, and we want any mode offered rather than.
Mr. Chair, it's also in the title that we have to make a change.
Okay.
Any mode offered?
Right.
And the move, you're going to change choose to accept on that line
above. Right. Change choose to accept or decline any mode offered of obtaining health care services.
Give me the line, please.
Yeah, we're on page 1, line 10.
Respectfully, you're better to say any offered mode.
Well, that's why it's conceptual. We'll just let the drafter get the English right.
So those changes will be made on lines 1 and 9-10.
Correct. 1 and 9-10. On page 1. At least now we have it offered. And is there an objection? No objection. The amendment is accepted or adopted, I guess, the term. Here's the plan, folks. I think I'm going to set this aside. I'm not here Monday, and Representative Thompson will be chairing the committee on Monday, and I'm giving him the option of passing it out if he has the votes. So, any objection to adjourning? With that, we're adjourned.
Happy weekend. See everyone at